Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. On Tuesday, March 25th, Tech Policy Press hosted a webinar discussion to talk shop with others on the tech and democracy beat. We gathered seven colleagues from around the world to explore how tech journalists are grappling with the current political moment in the United States and beyond. In this episode, you'll hear the first session of the day, which features my discussion with Michael Masnick from TechDirt, Victoria Elliott from Wired, and Emmanuel Myberg from 404 Media. This session explored the intersection of technology and the current political situation in the U.S. Key questions included, how are tech journalists addressing the current situation, and why is their perspective so crucial? What critical questions are journalists covering the intersection of tech and democracy currently asking? And how does the field approach reporting on anti-democratic phenomena and the challenges journalists face in this work? After you listen to this episode, make sure to check out the second segment, hosted by my colleague, Tech Policy Press Associate Editor Ramcha Jahangir, in the next episode. Let's get started. So good morning, everyone. Welcome wherever you are in the world, whatever time it is. We're going to have a conversation exploring really how tech journalists are grappling with the current situation in the United States and its implications abroad. Hopefully, we'll hear a little bit about the ways in which technology and technology issues are intersecting with the political democratic crisis in the United States. And also, I think, learn a little bit about patterns that we've seen elsewhere in the world, certainly in the global majority, where some of these phenomena, sadly, are not new at all. There are many things to learn, I think, from our colleagues abroad who've been covering these issues in some dire circumstances elsewhere and beginning to see patterns emerge in the situation in the United States that I think they recognize. And so we've got two sessions this morning, one that will focus on the domestic context and one that will focus more squarely on the situation abroad, the sort of reaction to what's happening in the United States, and hopefully some of the ideas that we can learn from those who've been covering anti-democratic phenomena abroad. And I'm joined for this first session by three esteemed colleagues, quite pleased to have here Victoria Elliott, a reporter at Wired who covers platforms in power, although I would perhaps say that Tories current beat seems to be all Doge all the time. So we'll hear a little bit, I'm sure, about that. And then, of course, Mike Masnick, founder and editor of the TechDirt blog. And I think fair to say blog because Mike has been blogging there for really some time and has perfected the form of the blog in TechDirt. And then more recent entrant onto the ecosystem, Emmanuel Myberg, who is a journalist and editor and one of the founders of 404 Media, which I'm sure many of you are aware of as well, doing an excellent job covering many of the phenomena that I'm sure we'll discuss today. So really grateful to the three of you for joining me and looking forward to what you are working on, hearing how you frame up your coverage and your general effort this morning. And I'm going to come to each of you and ask you a question that hopefully will let you explain what's top of mind for you, what you're focused on at the moment, and how you're thinking generally about this broader context, about the political situation in the U.S., how it relates to coverage of technology, the role of technology. And I suppose I don't need to say to the three of you, but I'll say for the benefit of our audience, of course, there's so many themes that are related to technology that run through everything that we're seeing in the news of late, from the role of artificial intelligence in the restructuring of federal agencies and the kind of underlying motivation at the Department of Government Efficiency run, perhaps, I'm not sure exactly where we're at on the legal distinction, by Elon Musk, social media surveillance in the immigration conversation. So much issue there. Questions around privacy, encryption, a looming battle, it appears, over Section 230.
lots of questions about what the new administration will do when it comes to handling big tech, which appears to have aligned in many ways with the administration's interests. So much to get into, but by way of framing things up, I'm going to come to each of you. And Mike, perhaps I'll start with you, because you published a blog post recently where you put it fairly plainly that you feel your job is to very much cover democracy and cover this crisis, even as you cover these tech issues. So perhaps I'll give you the microphone for just a moment to explain how you're thinking about this moment.
TechDirt has always covered a whole bunch of different issues beyond just technology. We were never really entirely focused on being a technology blog. We were covering law and policy and economics and civil liberties and all these kinds of things. What I noticed was that since the election and definitely since the inauguration, that we were covering more and more stuff that was specifically, you know, more on the legal political side of things than on the sort of tech or tech policy side of things. And a few people asked me about it. And so I finally wrote up this thing that said, effectively, all of the things that we have talked about for the previous 27 years that we've been around didn't matter as much if the entire framework of the United States of America completely collapses. The institutions that we rely on, we don't just write about the US. We've always tried to make sure that we were writing for a global audience and about global things. But obviously, the US is so intertwined with, for good and bad, with just about everything else around the world, that it matters there as well. It basically came down to a recognition that some of the things that we normally would write about just didn't matter as much if the entire US collapses, whether that is just the constitutional order or the US economy or any of these other things that might be impacted. And so I just felt that it was worth calling out that the things that we needed to cover had to be that. It also mattered that because of the way that the Trump administration has been set up and its very close relationship to some elements of the tech industry, obviously Elon Musk and Doge, and whether or not he's actually running Doge, which is a ridiculous question, but one that is actually at stake in some of the court rulings. The number of people from the sort of venture capital industry that are advising or helping the administration, all of these things where they are people and tactics that we have experience covering. And so the thing that I noticed was that the traditional tech reporters and the three of us on this panel, I would say the two others on the panel, more than myself in terms of like straight reporting, certainly other colleagues as well that we all know who have been on the sort of tech beat for the last however many years, certainly the last 10 years, seem to be covering this moment much better than political reporters who seem to be taking it as they'll take what is being said and report it as this is what this person said, but not the actual implications of it and not what does this really mean, not being able to explore deeper, not being able to really get the kinds of scoops that, you know, especially the two other panelists on this panel have been able to get, in part just because we know these kinds of things better, because we've seen, especially with Elon Musk in particular, we've seen what he's done over the last few years. And so we recognize the patterns that for some reason, a lot of the political press has not been noticing.
Tori, perhaps it's a good place to come to you. Speaking of scoops, you have had, I'd have counted this number over the last couple of months. And just prior to starting this recording, mentioned that you may have just had a chance to put your laptop down for the first time this weekend. Hopefully you got a little rest. But it's been an extraordinary breakneck speed for coverage at Wired, particularly of Doge. Lots of information apparently coming to you over the transom. Folks reaching out. Wired's become a real a gravitational pull for that type of coverage. Can you explain how you're thinking about things and what it's been like for you and the rest of the reporters there over the last couple of months.
Yeah. So I think the thing that I was struck by once we broke our first set of stories. So like the first story I did on Doge was actually not like a super scoopy one. It was following the executive order that established Doge. And I went and talked to a bunch of experts and some former USDS, GSA government people who could explain the importance of why USDS, the US Digital Service, now the US Doge Service, was such a almost like legally ingenious way for them to establish Doge. Because before then, everyone had thought it would be a federal advisory committees, of which there are like thousands and they're important, but they aren't particularly powerful, right? And so the first piece that we did actually was just a piece explaining the sort of what someone called like the legal jujitsu that they did. That was actually, in the estimation of a lot of experts, really unexpected and really smart. And it was from that sort of initial explanatory reporting, which a lot of other publications were not doing. They weren't necessarily getting into the executive order. And what does it mean when you have an executive order that appropriates a service that is literally allowed to access any IT system in government that's not classified? Like, what could you do with that? And it was from that that we started to get people reaching out to be like, hey, have you looked at this? And from there, once we did the first couple of Doge stories about OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, GSA, the General Services Administration, that thing really broke and just kept coming. And I think it was that, like, we are, our audience is not a general audience, so they're okay with being in the nitty-gritty details of some nerdy shit with us. One of the stories that I did last week was talking to government auditors about what an audit looks like. And I don't actually know that there are a ton of mainstream publications where that would be a banger article for their audience. But it is with Wired. And I think because we have that like understanding that maybe our audience has this baseline understanding or baseline interest, that we can get a little deeper, a little quicker. But I think fundamentally, even more than that, like, we've just been paying attention to the tech industry. I've had tons of podcasts and media outlets be like, how did you guys know? And it's, we listen to their podcasts and we listen to their interviews and we read their tweets and we take them seriously. That doesn't mean that they're going to be able to do everything they want to do with their access to government, but nobody was keeping any secrets. You know, Musk has been saying for a year, 2 years, 3 years that he wants to fundamentally rip the teeth out of the administrative state. I think that we can believe that's what he's going to try and do when he gets into government, whether or not experts think that's a smart idea or not.
Emmanuel, I'll come to you next. You in particular have been covering various phenomena, somewhat similar to Tory, but one thing in particular I'm hoping you'll comment on is your coverage of immigration issues, ICE in particular, immigration and customs enforcement. You've been following some of the surveillance activity there. You've been following the technology that's being deployed, the way it's being deployed. How are you thinking about this particular moment when it comes to coverage at 404? And you're a new publication, so I'm sure you're trying new things, even as you continue to grapple with this situation.
Yeah, I think maybe unexpectedly, if we are doing new things, they are mostly on the business end of 404 Media and having to run a business while doing journalism. A lot of that, all of that is new to us because we haven't done that before in this way. In terms of our reporting, I would actually say that not a lot has changed in our process. We've been doing this for a long time. We've been working together for a long time. We have had years to develop strategies that we believe work for most situations. And obviously, I share the alarm that you describe, and we're approaching this moment with a lot of seriousness. But in terms of what we do day to day, it's the same. And there's, I don't know, there's a lot to it, obviously, but I want to highlight two key concepts that really define our stories, I think. And one is, this was true at Motherboard, which is the tech publication and advice where we all worked before we founded 4-4. And that is, a lot of our reporting is bottom up. So rather than trying to get the scoop from high level executives at tech companies, we approach and build contacts and sources at the lowest levels of these companies and users as well. So we want to talk to warehouse workers at Amazon. We want to talk to Uber drivers. We want to talk to low-level employees at Facebook and work our way up and understand how the company works from that perspective. And that is definitely true right now. It's true about the tech companies, and it is especially true in the government, where the entire theory of what Elon Musk is doing is very devastating to low-level or just like the average government employee. So there's a lot of people to talk to, and they have a lot to say about how this is impacting the government, how it's going to impact the average person, how it's impacting them. And I think we learn a lot about, like, there's what Doge is doing, and there is understanding like the ripple effect is going to have. We're very focused on both of those, but I think you can really understand what is going to happen and what is happening by talking to the people who do the work. So, for example, I've just been in the past 2 weeks really focused on talking to researchers who had their funding pulled and seeing what kind of research the US is going to lose to other countries, or that is going to disappear entirely because we're no longer funding scientists. And then the other thing that has always been key at Motherboard and now at 4-4 Media is just, it's a scary moment for the press and for free speech and the First Amendment. But all that being said, there is still a lot going for us for being reporters in the US, and there's transparency laws and there's FOIA and there is the First Amendment still. We just really focus on public record. So when you talk about ICE, Joseph Cox, who does a lot of that reporting and at this point has really good sources at people in that industry, we get stories that way. But a lot of that reporting and the way that trust is built is reporting on public documents. These are government contractors. These are the ways agencies describe that they use these private sector tools in government agencies that we just get by using the law to our advantages and asking for those records. So those are just like two things that we have always done. And I think the reason we do that is because they complement no matter what beat we're approaching or whatever moment we're approaching, but they're obviously especially helpful given everything that's happening right now during the Trump administration.
Mike, I want to come to you on something that Emmanuel mentioned there, First Amendment. We're seeing lots of essentially threats to free speech. We're seeing lots of political retaliation for speech. We're seeing lots of threats against universities and media organizations. How are you thinking about that phenomenon right now? I know it's something that you're covering, of course, but I don't know, what do you see as far as the constellation of events? What does that tell you about what we can expect?
Yeah, there's a lot of scary stuff going on right now, in particular with free speech and the First Amendment. I think the administration is attacking speech at a rate we haven't seen in modern history. Tragically, they are doing so while claiming to be bringing back free speech, and they use the language of free speech to cloak themselves while at the same time attacking speech at an unprecedented rate. And that it should be a major concern. I'm extremely disappointed in, again, a lot of the traditional media taking them at face value on the free speech claims. And again, this goes back a little bit to, this happened with Elon Musk and the takeover of Twitter, in which he also cloaked himself in the fake claims of bringing free speech back to that platform, which was never the case. And he has a long track record from before he even took over Twitter of attacking speech and using the courts and the power of government to suppress speech in all sorts of dangerous ways, filing all sorts of terrible lawsuits. We're seeing that across the board with this administration. The FCC in particular, led by Brendan Carr, was put into office again with the statement that he was a free speech warrior. He again has a history, and those of us who have covered the FCC for years knew that Brendan Carr is not about free speech in any form, and it has been really evident ever since he took over the commission. He's using that power in an incredibly abusive way to attack all sorts of parties for their speech. He's sending out threatening letters. He's opening investigations. The most telling one was that in the previous administration, there were four different efforts to try and get TV station spectrum licenses renewals blocked. And that's usually a pretty pro forma thing. TV stations get spectrum, which they're licensing from the government, and they always, it's just a rubber stamp to get it renewed. But there were four attempts to get those blocked in the last administration, one of which was from a sort of left-leaning group against a Fox station, and three of which were from a single right-leaning group using different arguments for each one for other stations, generally for platforming Democratic politicians in some form or another, and they would make some sort of crazy argument about why that was violating some rule, and therefore the spectrum shouldn't be renewed. The previous administration, the FCC, and Jessica Rosenworcel, who was the chair, dismissed all four of those and noted in her write-up of them that following through on any of these would violate the First Amendment, and just made a very clear free speech stand, like, we're not in the business of policing speech under the First Amendment. And as soon as Brendan Carr took over a week later, he reinstated the three that were brought by a right-leaning group against TV stations for platforming Democratic politicians. That is a very clear attack on free speech. And that's just one example. We've seen, obviously, the Trump executive orders, the attacks on universities for the kinds of research that they're doing. We're seeing the attacks on law firms for the clients that they're taking and the sorts of legal defense that they're doing. There is just a constant attack on people for their association rights and their free speech rights. We've seen talk about attacks on the press. Those haven't been quite as strong yet, but those are definitely coming. And so there's just constant attacks. The one good thing, and there's no good news in all of this, but the one thing, Emmanuel mentioned that we do technically still have a First Amendment, even though that itself and the underpinnings of that have been under attack going back really since the beginning of the first Trump administration, is that the courts to some extent are still holding on the First Amendment. It's a bit of a pain. We did have good news yesterday in which there has been an attempt for a while to overturn New York Times v. Sullivan, which is the key case for defamation law in the U.S. that really protects the press and has been incredibly important for the press. And there's been this strong effort among the kind of MAGA right to get rid of that ruling and overturn that ruling. There was a direct attempt to do so in a case filed by Steve Wynn against some reporters who did some reporting he didn't like. And it was challenged at the Supreme Court, and was very clearly like, should the Sullivan precedent be overturned? The Supreme Court yesterday rejected that, which I take as a good sign, meaning we knew that there were at least two and probably three justices who are interested in overturning Sullivan. But if they couldn't take that case, that means they don't have enough votes for that, which means they wouldn't have enough votes to overturn it. So I'm hopeful that the courts still hold. I'm not confident that they will, but for now, we still have that aspect.
That does seem to be one of the underlying questions, whether the courts will hold generally at a lot of these issues. Tori, I want to come to you on this question, but in particular, a lot of your coverage, of course, is focused on Doge, is focused on Elon Musk. About a year ago, Elon Musk tweeted or posted or whatever they're calling it these days, that many years ago, Wired somehow went from being about technology to being an unreadable far left wing propaganda mouthpiece. He's clearly not as happy with Wired as he was a decade ago when he quite appreciated your coverage of his Model S and things of that nature. How do you calculate the risk that is posed by covering Musk in particular in this moment?
I think that's like a hard question to answer. On a personal level, I echo the sort of concerns around the fact that though all the work that everyone on this panel does is entirely legal in the United States in terms of protection by the First Amendment and then by judicial precedent that has since been established either with Sullivan or Barnicki or like many other cases. I think the biggest thing for me that I think about is that, again, people like Musk and Trump are very open about what their goals are. They're very open about what they want to see and possibly sometimes the methods through which they're hoping to bring it into being. When Musk said that, for instance, possibly naming people who were part of Doge was a criminal act, which it's not, that could be a nod for it's not right now, but it does raise fears on a personal level of could we see an executive order that looks quite similar to the way that law firms have been targeted for the work they're doing? And that doesn't mean that's legal, and that doesn't mean that changes the type of reporting that anybody should be doing. We have laws in the U.S. to protect this type of work. But that doesn't mean that they're not initially broadcasting their displeasure. And I think the other thing about this is Wired is small, and we have a lot of support from our team here, and I'm very grateful for that. But we've also seen Trump bring cases against ABC, against other media outlets, and they've settled. So I think that in general, we are seeing a group of people who sees the media as fundamentally an adversarial force and who has a lot of money to try and make at least some of that problem for them go away. And again, I don't know if that changes our calculus. I think it means that we are incredibly diligent. We do the work. We have the highest standards that we can possibly have for ourselves. And I think the bigger thing too is that when everything is so chaotic, it is, and everyone's trying to drive scoops because that's like what gets you clicks, it can be very easy to make mistakes. And so I think just in general for the media industry, not necessarily like for Wired, but just in general for all of us, that it can be easy to fall into the pace that the administration is setting with how quickly everything is moving to feel like we have to match that. But the reality is that we are at a time where trust in institutions and media is so low. Like, it is so much more important to take the breath to get it right, to even if you're coming at it a couple hours or a couple of days later, to do the best version of the thing that you can possibly deliver and not fall into the traps of moving quickly.
We do have a couple of questions already from folks who are participating, and they're on a related theme. There's a question first around how traditional media could work better to perhaps maybe learn some of the lessons of influencers on social media to reach a bigger audience and to counter what the questioner phrases as far-right conservative actors and their prominence in the media ecosystem. There's another question that sort of addresses this as well around the kind of visible asymmetry in the information ecosystem at the moment. I don't know, how do each of you think about that? Emmanuel, maybe I'll come to you on that. Are there things that perhaps you're learning about how to, as you think about the business of 404, how to make your message heard, get your content out in an environment that is in some ways, I suppose, hostile to the type of information you're publishing?
Yeah, I think the short answer is that people value new information regardless of their politics. So when we publish scoops, they travel far and wide and they travel beyond the filter bubbles that you would imagine they would stay contained in, and maybe they morph and they change and people spin them in different ways. I'm sure Victoria and Mike have had this experience, but it's like, we'll publish a scoop and the Drudge Report will pick it up and put it on its front page and have some conservative spin on it. Or I know the site has turned anti-Trump in recent years, but our stories will get picked up by New York Post and Fox News and Daily Mail and all these tabloids. And I think that's overall good because the information is getting out there and that is leading more readers to 4-4 Media. And we see this time and time again. We're the reporters, we run the business, we see all the data, we see what brings people to the site, we see what converts them from free subscribers to paid subscribers. We see what fosters loyalty from readers and trust. And there are other things you can do on the margins, but if we have a big scoop, people come and read it. And that's what people want to read. And that's what makes them want to support us and what builds trust and all that.
Mike, how do you think about this question?
It's a tough one, right? And to some extent, it's a question that gets at what is the media today and what does it need to be and how should it be acting? And something that I think this goes back years before the sort of current crisis is that there is value in actually being able to one, be authentic, right? And this is what we're seeing with like the influencer ecosystem, even if a lot of us can look at it and say there are aspects of it that are not very authentic, but what a lot of consumers of news are looking for are more authentic experiences that don't feel as rehearsed or as, I don't want to say like plastic, but that's not quite the right description, but there is something that people are looking for. And part of that also is more willingness to explain why things matter. And so I think a lot of consumers of news are searching for that explanation. We're living in somewhat chaotic times, perhaps less chaotic than some would tell you, but really chaotic times, and people are searching for understanding. There is a strong hunger for people who will explain stuff in ways that actually put stuff into context and make things understandable. That has opened up the market to people who are doing so through misinformation and nonsense and building an audience by telling people what they want to hear. But I think that a lot of the traditional media has fallen into a standard way of delivering news in a way that is the sort of like, we're the authority, we're giving you just a sort of description of what happened. And that doesn't feel like enough for a lot of consumers of the news. And I think that is where certainly a lot of the right-wing media ecosystem has found success, is that they're trying to get in and explain stuff. And I think that is also where I think the three of us on this panel, and certainly a number of other folks who are really trying to get deeper into the weeds, right? The reporting that certainly Wired has done over the last few years and that 404 Media has done, these are not the typical reporting. It's not the same kind of reporting that you're going to see on a CNN or an NBC. In some cases, the Washington Post or the New York Times, some aspects of them will get there, but really being able to explain stuff, put stuff into context so that people have a better understanding of it, that is what a lot of people are seeking. And a lot of the traditional press, and certainly, you know, I don't want to tar everybody, but certainly a number of folks in the political press, they're just doing the sort of, this is what happened. This is what so-and-so said. This is what he said. This is what she said. It's what Jay Rosen has certainly called the view from nowhere quite frequently. I think all of us on this panel and a lot of the more successful media people today have some element of a point of view. That's not to say that it's a strong bias or something, but we have a point of view and we're getting it out there. And I think that is resonating with audiences.
Can I add one thing to that? The world is very confusing. Just open your Instagram, go through Reels, and it's just a crazy experience processing all the information that's coming at you. And what is real and what is fake, and why are people even posting this stuff, and so on. And there's a lot of value we found in explaining to readers how stuff works. Like, even we have a perspective, but even leaving the perspective aside, we see a lot of traction in just explaining, okay, there's this image of Taylor Swift, this AI-generated nude image of Taylor Swift is going super viral on Twitter, and everybody is covering, but something that we were able to add in that case is explain who made it, why did they make it, where did they make it, why is anyone even doing this? And people really want to find that out. That's useful to them. We've also, some of our biggest story this year so far in the past 12 months has been just explaining, okay, you're seeing all this crazy AI-generated slop on Facebook. Everybody knows this. Everybody is writing about it. But we've been able to explain, again, who is making it? Why? How are they making it? And that's something people really want to know. And it helps them understand all this crazy stuff that they're seeing and why they're seeing it. I find that to be very useful to readers as well.
Yeah, I would also say that one thing that I think there's been a big difference on is, like, I don't come from a background of political reporting. And so I feel like, in a way, I mean, I've done a lot of policy reporting, but I feel like I'm learning with my audience in a way, which is super helpful. But I do think that a lot of traditional political reporting is also based on this sort of relationship building and maintenance, where maybe you're going to drinks with people and they're telling you stuff informally and they can get you into this thing, but please don't write about that. There's this, for lack of a better word, politicking around even being a political reporter, because that is just how that industry is, and therefore, like, the kind of relationships people build. And there's a lot of value placed on those kinds of relationships. But I think when you cover the tech industry, like, there's no amount of me going to drinks with someone at Meta that's going to make them give me valuable, scoopy, important information. There's no amount of playing nice or doing favors or building even personal relationships with people at those companies that's going to allow me to do my job. And so I think part of the reason that tech reporters in general have come to this moment maybe a little better armed is because we are constantly working from a position of being at the margins of the industry and trying to get information out of it, rather than trying to get into the center of the industry, into the room where things are happening, in order to get information that way, and, like, trying to build relationships to facilitate that.
That's an excellent point. And I want to say we have 5 minutes left for this segment, and we've got multiple questions that kind of get at a couple of things that I want to just bring up for conversation. One, there's multiple questions that are interested in how this moment is for the business of tech journalism. And we've got two founder editors here as well. And I know that Wired has been public about seeing essentially uptick in subscriptions and uptick in readership, certainly from its work. So I want to kind of address that, how you all might be thinking about that. And then a question also about whether this context may open up the opportunity for more collaboration across media. That was one of the motivations for me, even setting up this webinar with my colleagues at Tech Policy Press. We're always very keen to work with others and hear how things are going, compare notes across the field. But who would like to take perhaps this question on what this has meant for their business, how they're thinking about their business going forward, and perhaps whether the moment opens us up to more collaboration?
I can jump in quickly. The business side is, we're finding out. It's an interesting moment in that some of the traditional, like, sponsors that we've had for certain things are now shying away from sponsoring stuff just because they don't want to be seen as supporting something that might put them in the crosshairs of stuff. That's represented, I think, some challenges and some concerns. Not that we make any of our coverage decisions based on that, but it's something that we've certainly noticed, that organizations that we may have gone to sponsor events or things like that in the past are suddenly less willing to do. At the same time, I think it's opening up. people who actually are concerned about democracy and are concerned about the moment that we're in. We've seen definitely a noticeable growth in direct user support, which I know 404 relies on heavily. And we've definitely seen some of that come in as well. That's been really welcome and a useful moment. But I think a lot of what we're doing now, the stuff when I'm not spending 22 hours a day writing, is often trying to figure out, like, how do we make sure that this organization can stay alive at this moment? And it's in some ways more challenging than it's been in the past, even as we're seeing more direct support from readers.
Emmanuel. So the Trump bump, as they call it, is real, I think. There's a surge of interest in what we cover. More people are coming to the website. More people are subscribing to the website. And that's good for business. I would say, on the other hand, there are two things that counteract that. One is a lot of people, thousands and thousands of people, a lot of them working in government agencies that are doing fairly technical jobs that are very interested in what we do. They're losing their jobs and they're losing their income. And we're seeing the impact of that as well. And then also, I think while we are going to retain a lot of this audience that is suddenly interested in us, we're going to lose a larger share of them later on compared to other surges of interest once they get fatigued by the news cycle and are no longer interested. I don't think they're as loyal as a readership. All that being said, this is stuff that I think about constantly and I'm aware of as someone who owns the business, but we also have to compartmentalize that. So I put that aside, not just because it makes reporting difficult when you're constantly thinking about the business. I also think it's just good business for us to focus on the reporting and not consider this stuff too much. Our theory is we're going to come in every day. We're going to do the best reporting that we can do. Every decision that we make as reporters and as business owners is about how do we produce the best journalism that we can do. And somehow that is going to lead to us having a sustainable business. That's how we've done things so far. That's how we're going to continue to do them no matter what is happening in the news. And so far that has worked. So that's what we're going to do.
Tori, last word on this and last word for this session on you.
I think more divorced from the financial side of stuff because we're just like a bigger publication. To your point on partnerships, like we have a partnership with 404 and we are now making any stories that are based off of FOIAs unpaywalled because obviously FOIAs are public information. There's definitely much more of a openness, I think, to that because this moment is so particular. I will say that for us, we are also seeing that uptick in subscribership and audience engagement. And we are really trying to build those relationships so that people feel like they understand our product. We've hosted webinars, for instance, where subscribers can come and they can ask us questions and hopefully can get a sense of how we produce the journalism or the things that we're concerned about or ask follow-ups to stories that maybe they were interested in, but they wanted to know more and they can submit those ahead of time. And that's also been a really great way that we've captured feedback about what people are interested in or areas that they wish we were covering more. So we are trying to recognize that we've gotten these influx of readers, that we are really grateful that this whole new cohort of people are trusting us and seeing us as the outlet of Doge Record, I guess, at least more than anything else, but also trying to say, okay, how do we really make sure that people are getting what they feel they need out of their relationship with us? Because ultimately, it is a relationship with us. And I definitely agree with Emmanuel that the best thing that we can do for them is continue to provide useful new information that helps them understand and navigate a really fast changing and complex world and do so in a way that is discernible to them and give them a level of transparency about who we are and what our priorities are and how we're approaching it.
I'm grateful to all three of you for doing that. And we didn't get to talk about it, but I'm also grateful for the stamina of the individuals on this call. I know how much personal pain and effort that has gone into what you've been up to for the last several months and probably running at a constant clip. Very grateful to you. I'm going to draw this session to a close with a thanks to Emmanuel, to Mike, to Tori. I hope that each of you will go and find them on whichever social media platform you prefer, but I know that they're all on Blue Sky these days, and that you'll, of course, subscribe to their work, pay them for their work, if possible, and continue to pay attention to the work that they're doing. And thank you to the three of you.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to our guests. Thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones. Thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.